Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about the end of college as we know it. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Imagine seeing this headline: sign up for college tuition free at the University of Everywhere. Well, guess what? That's a real thing, not a fake one. In Connecticut and across the nation, students of all ages can now enroll in top flight college courses online for free and receive credit for them in many places. How can universities afford to do this? My guest says higher education must adapt to the demands of the digital planet or become irrelevant. The money part will be figured out later. So far, the start of the new revolution appears to be working. The massive online courses, most of them tuition-free, are known by the acronym MOOCs, and students across the world are quickly enrolling at Yale, Wesleyan, Stanford, MIT, and Harvard, with more colleges jumping quickly on the digital bandwagon. We want you to join my guest to debate the pros and cons of this new wave. Kevin Carey has taken an MIT MOOC course. He's author of a book about this, Education Reconfiguration, The End of College. What are we losing and gaining if this continues to take off? Kevin Carey, welcome to the show.
It's wonderful to be here.
I want to have you walk us through how easy it is to sign up for these things and tell us what happened to you when you did this, taking a course with a rock star professor. So first of all, the background. The current organization of college, you're saying, is out of step and the industry's being rethought.
Yeah, the most colleges and universities as we know them today are based on an organizational model that really came about in the 19th century after the Civil War, but before the turn of the 20th century. We've been with these institutions for quite some time. They've been very, very successful in many ways. They remain objects of aspiration for students around the world, but they are becoming increasingly untenable, both in that no one can afford to go to them anymore. Anyone who's trying to put one child, much less two or three, through college can tell you just how astronomically expensive many college universities have become.
Well, let's do that part, because you say that the United States education system is the world's most expensive one. But what are the results showing us?
They aren't as good as we'd like to believe. Usually we excuse the vast cost of our colleges by saying, well, we have the best colleges and universities in the world. And that's true from a narrow perspective. Certainly among the world's great research universities, most of them are American. But, of course, most American college students don't go to Harvard or MIT. And if you look at the average reading and mathematics ability of an American college graduate and compare it to other countries, actually we're below average in math and only about average in reading. Really not that much different than the internationally mediocre results of our K-12 schools.
Okay, so this is where in steps the digital learning people. The first, according to your book, the first digital learning class began as a collaboration between Google and Stanford University. And that class, they thought 100 people would sign up. That class drew how many students worldwide?
I think there were several hundred thousand. And I do want to say
58,000.
It wasn't the first digital class. The colleges and people have been teaching online classes ever since the internet was invented, certainly, and the World Wide Web became available in the late 1990s.
So what would you call it, the first?
This was the first high-profile, large class offered for free by an elite American university.
And it was artificial intelligence with the rock star Stanford professor Sebastian Thurn.
He went on to form his own company called Udacity. His specialty is in artificial intelligence, and actually there are some very interesting and smart people at universities like Stanford and Carnegie Mellon and MIT who are researching how to use artificial intelligence to improve the quality of online education.
So 58,000 students around the world sign up for this.
I believe that's right.
Shocking, as you say in your book, to everybody concerned. So I would like you to tell us, I'm imagining right now that there are, I certainly had to take out loans to go to school. My parents died when I was in high school, and it was the only thing that I could do, and it enabled me to go to school. There are a lot of people listening right now who have piles of college debt, either for themselves or for their kids and grandkids. So this is big news. They may be gnashing teeth listening to this. Where was this when I was around? Walk me through what happened to you. You decided, more and more schools are doing this, you decided to sign up for one. Where was it? What was the class? And how hard was it to sign up?
The class was at a website called edx.org, which is a nonprofit organization run, created by Harvard and MIT, but it has partners in dozens of other very well-known universities, including the University of California at Berkeley, the University of Texas, the Sorbonne, the universities in Australia and Asia. It in many ways couldn't be easier. You just type in edx.org, click on the catalog of classes, put in a username and a password, which is something I think we've all become used to doing, and you're signed up. It takes about 5 minutes, which certainly is in mark.
And what I want to know is, what was your... Did I lose you?
The class.
So much for the internet. Yeah. Okay, Kevin, here's what's happening. We have lost some signal of yours. We don't know which one it is. So we're going to call you back. And while we're getting you back on the line, I'm going to tap dance for a minute. So here's what I want to know from Kevin. He's the author of The End of College, and it's about creating the future of learning and the university of everywhere. What we're seeing is that more and more universities across the country and, of course, the world are starting to do this. They see it's where it's going, and you think, how are they doing this, and, you know, how can it be free? I'm sure money will be involved at some point. So Kevin, you typed in, sorry we lost you, you typed in, you know, what you wanted to do, password and whatever. What class did you sign up for through MIT?
So this was Introduction to Biology. This is a mandatory class that all MIT freshmen are required to take. If you go to MIT, you have to take classes in biology, chemistry, physics, and calculus as part of their core curriculum. And so what MIT did was very faithfully recreate this class online. And so that spring, this was spring of 2013, there were 100 students taking the class in Cambridge, Massachusetts, all MIT students. And tens of thousands of people were taking exactly the same class online around the world.
With you.
And I was one of them.
Yeah.
So just the delay was about a week and a half or 2 weeks, because that's how long it took them to record all of the lectures and put them up online. So we watched the same lectures. We did the same homework assignments. We worked on the same problem sets. And this is a big part of the way science is taught in these kind of classes. You don't just kind of passively watch a lecture. You have to apply what you learned in solving very complicated problems and using simulated laboratories, manipulating different kinds of genetics and protein sequences. So it wasn't just kind of multiple choice. It was actually using some very interesting online tools to look at 3D models of how proteins organize themselves and how if you change part of a DNA sequence, what kind of mutations will occur. We took the same midterms. We took the same finals. We were graded on the same standards. And then at the end of the class, I got a certificate from MIT and edX saying that I had passed the class.
Okay, so here I want to know, I've got a whole bunch of questions about this, what this was like. I can see that because they filmed the actual lectures and set up this laboratory on the side for you to do the same problem sets and all that, that it was exactly like, in most ways, being in that classroom. Maybe not as intimate, but there you were. But but there were thousands and thousands of you around the world. Who did those? Who figured the, you know, who was grading those papers?
Well, the problem sets are actually graded automatically by a computer. And again, this is the same way that the problem sets were graded by for the students there. And some kind of subjects lend themselves to that sort of grading, and some don't. If this had been an English Lit class, I think there would have needed to be real people reading the essays, and that would have been a little bit of a different model from a person and a cost standpoint. But for certain kinds of subjects, this one included, the computer could do all the grading.
Wow. Now, did you and you got grades just as anybody else would get grades?
Yes.
Okay. Meaning letter grades or percentage pass fail?
How they gave percentage grades, so I ended up averaging an 87% over the entire
Good for you.
Yeah, not bad. I wasn't a science major, and so it felt pretty good for me.
Well, I would have flunked because.
Well, you never know.
That sounds really hard to me, but in any case. Now, did this cost you anything?
No, it was entirely free.
And how did you get accepted?
I didn't have to get accepted. Anybody can sign up for it.
Why is MIT, Wesleyan, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, why are these organizations participating in this? Why are they doing it?
I think two reasons, one altruistic and one self-interested. I think they think it's the right thing to do. These are institutions with enormous amounts of both financial wealth, but also educational wealth. They are brand names resonate. They have a lot of very, very smart people. They've invested in creating these classes. And before this happened, all that investment could only serve the 100 people that could fit inside that lecture hall. If there is a relatively low-cost way of getting tens of thousands of more people access to it, then that's a great thing for them to do. And I think, you know, the people there have spoken very frankly about how this is part of their mission as nonprofit institutions that are supposed to serve the public interest and have a global leadership position.
Well, that's all very nice. But now I get to the fact in your book, which is about the funding that is coming for these companies that are doing this, you know, gathering up all these courses and taping them and creating online labs. And these are venture cap people. It's like, investing in any business. So they see this as a business. The venture cap funding has gone up, or investing has gone up amazingly. Digital learning classes now, the venture cap money is now at $1.2 billion. So I'm assuming that they see money written on the wall.
Well, it depends. edX is nonprofit. It's not venture capitalist backed. It's just backed by Harvard and MIT. I suppose you could argue that Harvard and MIT are also venture capitalists given the size of their endowments, but they're nonprofit organizations, and so they're not doing it to make large amounts of money. Now, there are other providers of these kinds of courses, most prominently a company called Coursera and one called Udacity, that are backed. They are for-profit, backed by venture capitalists, and they do presumably have a profit model sitting at the end of that investment.
Right. And do those ones that have a profit model, I think Wesleyan does Coursera courses, do the universities get a little bit of money?
It is a partnership between the universities and the company, so they will share the profits that come.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we see how that money is going to work. On the other hand, we also see that this really reduces the bills for people taking those courses. Now the question is, how useful are they to these students? What is it like not to be with other human beings and be doing this just online? What kind of certification do you get that an employer would be impressed by? And are actual college lecture classes, dormitory experiences going to be for the elite only? All these questions addressed in your book, The End of College, and much, much more. Very interesting reading, Creating the Future of Learning and the University of Everywhere. This is happening all around us right now. We have more to say about this. Don't go away. I'm Faith Middleton, and if you have access to a computer and the internet, you can take top-flight college courses from major institutions around the world, and you can take them for free. It is an amazing moment in education, absolutely startling. If you are swamped in college debt at the moment, you might be saying, why did this not happen before? But there are a lot of questions to clear up here. And we're going to Kevin Carey, who is author of The End of College. This book is about creating the future of learning and the University of Everywhere. Kevin signed up for one of these courses online in the easiest way. It's a course in biology that is required at MIT. He ended up passing that course, taking all the same classes, lectures, problem sets that the people actually in the classroom took, and he received a certificate that he had passed the course. And so, Kevin, I want to open the phones at 203-776-WNPR. If you have questions about this, I'm sure you do. Please jump in right now about the pros and cons of this. 203-776-WNPR. Kevin, were you able to say, to ask questions, to say as I would? I had fellow students tutoring me in chemistry in high school, my friends, because I was not getting it. And so they said, we'll help you. And so I would work with them after school to try and understand this. And I just barely passed that class. So who did you talk to?
So I did talk to other students. I talked to them online. There were a series of forums set up on the same website that hosted the course itself, where you could log on and ask certain kinds of questions. Obviously, not talking to someone face to face; it's all based on text. But you know, we've become pretty used to in our society engaging with other people online through all variety of social networks, and this was no different. And the nice thing about it was because people were taking the class around the world at any time, day or night, there was someone online who was kind of working away at these same problems and could help us out. And some of the teaching assistants from the class also monitored these discussion forums and would weigh in with answers themselves.
And the answers were clear enough and understandable enough to actually help you?
They were. Yeah, I think it's a very well-designed course. MIT has been teaching this stuff for a long time. The model is a pretty straightforward educational model. I actually went up to Cambridge and sat in on one of the lectures for real and kind of watched the whole process. And I figured out that I actually liked taking it on my computer better because...
Why?
Because I could pause it. It seems kind of simple to say that, but the lectures, as you said, a pretty challenging topic. And if I needed to kind of stop and go back and listen to what the professor said again, maybe look something up online because there was a particular term that was a little troublesome to me, or I wanted to sort of stop and take extra long notes, I could just hit pause and do that and then go back to start the lecture. Seeing the lecture in person, I couldn't pause him. I had to just sit.
Uh-huh. And did you feel at all like a second-class citizen? You saw the class where the actual high-paying students were,
yeah,
and the actual professor. And then you were with the anonymous people on the internet, which has its own cool to it. Did you feel a second-class thing at all?
You know, there was a moment at the end of the class I saw where a bunch of the students kind of met after the class and were just kind of chit-chatting with the professor. And I think part of me kind of wished that I could have been one of those people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm 44 years old. I have a degree. I have a family. I live in another city. And I don't have $57,000 to pay MIT to have that privilege, and they wouldn't let me in anyway. And so it was missing a little bit, but I think not missing all that much.
Wow. Okay, we've got a call. Fred, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Well, I'd like him to comment. There are two colleges that have a very different model. I know one of them very well, Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. They take one course at a time. Their motto is, we can do anything in 18 days. And they get 3 to 5 times as much contact hour with faculty. There are no distractions. That's a very different model. And it complements. I mean, the MOOCs is very exciting, but it is the conventional framework. And Cornell College achieves amazing outcomes because it has so many more contact hours, and they take students off campus to study geology by going in the national parks. It's a very different kind of, and I wondered what his perception is on an alternative model that really would complement MOOCs rather than competing with.
That's such a good point, Fred. Kevin, what do you say? Is there any substitute for what Fred's describing?
In some ways, no. I think in nowhere in the book do I suggest that we can entirely replace the experience of face-to-face interaction between people. And I very much believe the future of education is actually not one in which we all learn by ourselves in front of our computers. It's just going to depend an awful lot on the person, the educational program, and the kind of learning that makes sense for them and what they're trying to achieve. For some people, it will actually be wonderful because they have families and lives and want to, and actually can learn well that way. For other people who really do need the kind of face-to-face support that makes a difference in education, what I think we'll be able to do is create new learning organizations that are kind of like colleges, but kind of not like colleges, that take advantage of all of the new economies of scale and all of the resources that we now can get using the internet and using technology. Build on that as a foundation so you don't have to spend a lot of money creating a very expensive new introduction to genetics class if MIT's already done that for you. And then build on top of that with face-to-face instruction and interaction, but students only have to pay for the cost of that, which I think is going to be a lot less than they're paying now.
Fred, thank you so much for your great points and your question. Economies of scale, can you explain what you mean by that?
It's not free to create one of these classes. I think it costs MIT hundreds of thousands of dollars to just do all the work of videotaping the class and creating the online system and putting all the problem sets online. So if they were only teaching 100 students, that's not a very good investment. When you're teaching, say, 50,000 students, it's a very good investment. It's much, much less expensive per student. And that's what I mean by economies of scale.
Okay. Carol Faith Middleton with Kevin Carey, author of The End of College. Go ahead. Hi, Carol.
Hi, this is Carol. Kevin, by the way, did you... First of all, I took my MBA through the University of Phoenix, which I thought was a great program.
Good.
It was very similar. I did it many years ago, but I'm a graduate of the University of Virginia undergrad. When I did it back 20 years ago, I was a single parent, and it was the best place for me to go to be able to get the education that I needed without having to travel to Brown or Yale or UConn or wherever it was at the time. It paid off. I have an excellent six-figure-plus income in what I do. At the time, I wasn't sure it would carry much weight. I can remember interviewing for a job and somebody kind of laughing about it, but I was Phi Beta Kappa at UVA, and that shut them right up. So that was my concern, was the credibility of it. But since then, it has grown by leaps and bounds. Now, I understand University of Phoenix is in trouble, that they've lost half of their people. I think they had over 400,000 students taking classes in that. Now they're about 200 and some odd thousand, and maybe it's because of the way they were charging. I understand the MOOC programs are cutting into those programs that were more, financially based.
See, another good point. Carol, thank you so much for that.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. So, Kevin, you might not know about University of Phoenix. I don't know if you do, but what do you think? These are going to shake out? Which ones?
There was a real boom in online higher education. And again, the MOOCs didn't invent online higher education. It had been around for a while. And there were millions of students, actually, who enrolled, many of them at regular nonprofit colleges, but many of them also at for-profit colleges like the University of Phoenix, which are struggling now because I think in a lot of ways they expanded too quickly. There was a lot of money to be had out there precisely because of the economies of scale that we just talked about. If you build something and get a lot of people signed up, there's a lot of money to be made for the last student. I think a lot of it has to do, as the caller said, with pricing. Those degrees turned out to be very expensive. A lot of people took out loans to get that education, and they've had trouble paying their loans back. And so some of this retrenchment, I think, is just people adjusting to the fact that it really shouldn't be as expensive as a place-bound in-person education to take a class online.
And there's this issue of inspiration, and that comes from sometimes human contact more than it does from looking at a digital presence or hearing one. It's a little like in my mind taking out a gym membership, and you have great enthusiasm in the beginning and a sense of inspiration, and after a while, you just lose it in the gym. You just lose interest. It starts to seem boring or confusing or not exciting in some way. So as working with a personal trainer, let's say. So what's the comparison there, the loss of human contact?
So there's an interesting existing organization called Western Governors University, which is a nonprofit, fully accredited university. The education that it focuses on, mostly adult learners, people who are getting degrees in education, healthcare, and business, which is a lot of what our economy is comprised of. The education itself, the learning is online. These are all people taking classes from home, but every one of those people is assigned to a personal mentor, a real person that they can call up and talk to on the phone, someone who helps guide them, helps them make choices. If things start to get tricky or troubling, someone who can kind of walk them through their problems, stick with them all the way through their educational program. Western Governors isn't free because, of course, those human mentors need to be paid money. But it is a lot less expensive than a traditional graduate degree, maybe about a third as much as a traditional graduate degree. And that's a lot of what I think the future is going to hold, where we have these new organizational models where some of them, for people who don't need that support, the cost is very, very low. For people who do need more support, and absolutely those people do, there will be an additional cost, but it won't just be one model of pricing that kind of gets relentlessly more expensive, which is really the model we have now.
What, Kevin Carey, will employers think of this? How does someone who has taken courses perhaps relevant to that employer, or maybe not, present some kind of certificate that verifies this is what I've done? How do we know what employers will think?
That's a great question, and this is really the big thing that's being worked out right now. So we've already proven we can take some of these classes and translate them into an online environment. But, of course, the thing is, MIT didn't give me 3 credits from MIT. They gave me a certificate, but I couldn't, if I was enrolled in MIT, use those 3 credits to get an MIT degree. So what does that certification mean? Well, they're trying to answer that question right now. EdX, Coursera, some of these other companies have actually created sequences of classes where at the end you can go and take a series of exams in person, so they know you're the person who took the exam, and they give you a verified certificate that is in a practical field like data science, very high demand field in the American economy right now. And they're working with employers to educate them about what exactly the people who have these new credentials know and can do. I think it's going to take a little time for employers to get used to these new credentials. They've become, you know, human resources departments are very, they understand what a bachelor's degree is, they understand what an associate's degree is. They need to learn what these new things are, but I think that will work itself out in fairly quick order, as long as the classes are actually good.
You write about education a lot. This is slightly off topic, but I want to squeak this question in because I'd like to hear your answer in particular. There was someone in here who spoke to me recently, a university professor, and he said, I don't know why people don't enroll their kids in community colleges, 2-year community colleges, which are far less expensive, and work with these kids as closely as they can and say, if you get a great grade point average, we will then transfer you for the last 2 years to a really, you know, provided you get accepted, to a really terrific college, and your graduation degree will be at that terrific college, and we've saved 2 years of money.
Now, that's a good question, and it depends a lot on the state. Different states have set up their systems of community colleges in different ways. I think there's a couple reasons. Some people want to go and have that full 4-year residential college experience. They want to go to the football games and the fraternity parties and do all that stuff, and they'd rather do it for 4 years than just for 2. Another reason is that a lot of 4-year colleges, the policies that 4-year colleges have to accept transfer credits from 2-year colleges are often inconsistent. It's not guaranteed that all of your 2-year credits will transfer. That's really not a criticism of community colleges. I think sometimes 4-year institutions, that deal you described is such a good deal, they don't want people to have it. They would rather people pay for all 4 years from them if they're going to hand them a degree. And so I think people may have some reluctance there. This is something that, frankly, I think lawmakers need to work out, so that if a citizen of a state goes to a public community college, they should know with confidence that their credits will transfer to another public university.
Huh. Okay. I want to talk with you about grading. As you get great at taking these courses, we started this show by saying, just in case you're joining us, imagine seeing a headline, you know, sign up for college tuition free at the University of Everywhere. This is what's going on. There's an explosion of this across the country and around the world. Very important institutions of higher learning are offering these digital courses. My guest, Kevin Carey, took one at MIT through one of these organizations that offers it. It was free to him. He passed the course. It was exactly like the Introduction to Biology course that everybody else sitting at MIT was taking. And so he has passed. He knows what his grade is. Impressive to me. So if I can't believe that this is going on right now. You can take lots and lots of college courses at amazing universities and colleges all over the country and around the world for free right now. The End of College is Kevin Carey's book. Martin, welcome to the show. Go ahead, Martin.
Thank you, Faith.
You're welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment on something called the law of unintended consequences that might come from all this. First thing, I think that online education is an incredible advance in how we deliver education. But we also have to look at both ways in which education is delivered. I am a graduate of the University of Connecticut, PhD in genetics, and my advisor, Dr. Linda Strassbell, absolutely insisted that every one of her students teach classes, and actually towards the end of our careers as graduate students had to actually deliver lectures. Now the thing is, part of that experience from the graduate student preparation is learning how to prepare and learning how to deliver and learning how to interact with students. Now, if we extend putting all of these courses into venues where 10,000 or 20,000 or 50,000 students are taking them, then that really diminishes the prospect of graduate students getting that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And truthfully, that experience of learning how to prepare, learning how to interact, learning how to learn, because you never learn anything as well as you do when you teach it, that could have an unintended consequence of the real power of American education at the graduate level.
Yes, Martin, thank you so much for that comment. That this Martin, of course, addressing what might be gained and what might be lost by all these terrific online or digital courses from elite institutions, colleges and universities all over the country. What might be gained and lost? I guess they can't do everything. There are some things that are pretty eye-popping that they can do. Here is an example, I think, Kevin Carey, you might agree, of something that would be difficult to do, but who knows? Kevin, stay with me there. You might have a comment on that on the other side of this break. Quick break, and then we'll be right back with the end of college as we know it, but something else replacing it, quite possibly. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening to this show. It's fascinating stuff for me and a very interesting read, this book, The End of College by Kevin Carey, our guest. We are talking about what's going on, revolution in education, another one, I should say. There's been lots of revolutions in education, but this is big. This is using digital so that you have access. If you have access to the internet and a computer, you can sign up for free courses. There are organizations that are handling this, sometimes the universities themselves. The same classes that the students at these institutions are taking have been put online. You can get a certificate at many of these places saying that you passed the course, how, etc. It is really quite something. And there's a lot of venture cap money in this. The universities, in some cases, are splitting profits with these companies that are doing this. Who knows what the profit model is going to be down the road, but right now it's pretty good. It's free for people taking these courses. So we've been looking at what employers think, what it's like to take these courses, not in the room with everybody else, but away, and how far they have come within these universities and colleges to make this, to duplicate this, to make it so much like it is in those lecture halls and in those lecture rooms. This is quite a moment in education. So did you want to comment on our last caller by any case, Kevin Carey, when he was talking about, oh, when you're in graduate class, you're actually asked to teach something in front of others, and there's no substitute for that?
No, I thought those were some great comments.
Yeah.
A few things, I think. It sounds like he had a really good graduate advisor. I wish that all graduate students were required to practice and engage in teaching before they got their degrees. They aren't, however. It is very possible to get a job as a teacher in an American university without ever having taught anybody until your first day in the classroom. That happens all the time. It's kind of an odd thing. You need to get trained in teaching and certified to teach children, but not college students. And that, I think, is one of the reasons that the academic outcomes in many of our colleges and universities aren't very good. But he talked about unintended consequences, and you talked about what is to be gained and what is to be lost. I don't pretend there is nothing to be lost. I think technological disruption, it's a bit of an overused word, but of something that has been traditionally very labor-intensive has a real effect on the people who have been doing the labor. And I think that as things move in this direction from a learning standpoint, we're going to have to think hard about how we support the people who do the very necessary research and scholarly work in our colleges and universities, because in a lot of ways we've been supporting them through the teaching side of things.
What about spontaneity in a classroom when you're lecturing? We know that any good conversation has the main road and it has side roads. And the judgment is in whether to go down a side road at any given moment because of spontaneous thought or something somebody has said, something that's happened, and then when to come back to the main road. It is all spontaneous and very creative and can be the most gorgeous thing in life and really provide a true education. You know, how do we do that when 200,000 people are taking a class and the lectures are all perfectly crafted, and maybe that is lost? What are we losing there, I wonder?
I wouldn't disagree with that, and I think certain kinds of educational experiences will stay largely the same. That kind of deep personal engagement between student and teacher is not something that you can just replicate easily with a computer. I would observe that that is a kind of education that has only ever been available to a very small number of people. That's the world we live in now. That is not really the way most American college classes operate, and I would argue that if you're sitting in the back of a lecture hall with your laptop open, it's really not any different than sitting at your kitchen table with your laptop open, watching the lecture. There's not a lot of spontaneity and engagement in that kind of interaction, and that's more typical in many colleges than the sort of deep, spontaneous engagement. And again, we don't have to choose between one or the other. I think in the future we'll have institutions where the lecture is the lecture and it's inexpensive and it's online, and the engagement is the engagement and it's real and in person.
Yeah, I wonder, is this going to be first class, middle class, working class seating on an airline? That's what I'm wondering about. Ellen, Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm a retired professor of anthropology at one of the Connecticut State Universities.
Great.
And I've been intrigued with the possibilities of this kind of education for a long time. What bothers me is that I think it works better for some, it works very well for some subjects, and it doesn't work at all for others.
Uh-huh.
Clear controversy, for example, in introductory biology or Spanish or, well, think of something else that doesn't have a controversy.
Right, math.
And you don't need to develop an opinion. But in the social sciences and history, for example, how would you do it with a course on the Civil War or the future of the family or the solution to climate change problems? You want the audience to develop a experienced and sophisticated a group of opinions and see the range of things that are happening and come and realize how they are making their decisions themselves.
Yes, yes. Oh, such good points. I'm so glad you called, Ellen, because you know you've had your feet on the ground. You know what this is like, and you opened by saying you're intrigued with this, but you see great challenges also. Kevin Carey, author of The End of College, do you want to say something about that?
I agree with what the caller said. Let's start by doing a great job with the things where we can do a great job. If all we did was that, that would be an awful lot. The classes that the caller talked about, you know, less controversial, calculus, introduction to Spanish, biology, an awful lot of the course credits that are earned in American colleges are in those basic classes. And if we could find a way to, you know, kind of move our way up the ladder and offer a much better, lower-cost alternative for those course credits, that would be a huge cost savings to a lot of people. And they could use that cost savings to then probably pay additional amounts of money for exactly the kind of classes that the caller described, where you need much more of an in-person community, and we should expect much more diversity, absolutely, among the various institutions in terms of how they tackle those kinds of classes.
Right. You're talking about a hybrid model.
I think the distinction between in-person and online, which is a very sharp distinction now, is going to substantially fade over time.
Uh-huh.
It will really be a blend of an in-person and a technologically oriented experience.
Kevin, let me ask you something, as I wish Ellen had stayed on, because I wanted to get her take on this too. But what happens if, through this digital experience, what's lost is the sense that many people's points of view in a classroom where there's room for comment get spoken of. And one of the things we learn in high school, college, and university is that we must coexist with people who have differing points of view. And we don't hear that when you see the person, just one professor doing the lecture up there, and maybe there's no Socratic dialogue or opinions being given. It's just, here's what I tell you, and probably you spit this back at me, and then you get a grade. You see what's missing there?
I think you just described an awful lot of classes that already exist in existing colleges, and so I think we have to keep in mind not just our ideal vision of the best college class, but what people are already experiencing and spending a lot of money for. I also think that it really depends on the student. I mean, there are certain kinds of in-person environments where people may be more comfortable voicing their opinion in a little bit more of an intermediated way, where they might not want to stand up in class in front of everybody right there and talk, but in an environment where they can talk and interact, like, say, from their own home, that actually is a better environment for them. All of this is about creating a diversity of choices, both from an educational standpoint and from a price standpoint, so every person can find the educational environment that they can afford that really works for them, rather than only having one kind of institution charging one kind of price.
Do you think it's going to revolutionize the world in terms of what anyone with access to a computer and the internet can learn? You know, does it have that potential?
I think it does. It sounds grandiose to say that, but here are the facts. One of the biggest, most important changes to happen in all of human society over the last 40 years is the decline in global poverty. In 1980, over half of all the people on Earth lived below the global poverty line, $1.25 a day. That number has declined to around 20%, even as the number of people has increased to almost 7 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So a huge decline in global poverty, which means that between now and 2030, there are going to be about 3 billion people joining the global middle class.
Mm-hmm.
what's the first thing people want when they join the middle class? It means that they can put a roof over their head. They can provide food, safety, medicine, shelter. What they want is education.
Mm-hmm.
Education is opportunity. We are not going to educate 3 billion people, which is more than the total number of people who have ever gone to college in all of history, by building millions of new expensive American-style universities and charging everybody $50,000 a year to go there. It's economically impossible. For that emerging global middle class, the future of education is undisputably going to be online in some way. It is going to be technology-driven in some way. And I really do feel like this is an opportunity to liberate people with knowledge and with education in a way that was never possible before.
It's an exciting time. Kevin Karius, author of The End of College. I wonder, as we go to the phone right now, what this, when we look at all this data of all these people taking all these courses online now for free, what the data might tell us about how people learn. You get at this in your book.
We know very little about how people learn in some ways. I mean, there are a lot of very smart people, cognitive scientists, people studying psychology, neuroscience, who are trying to figure these things out. They're very complicated. The human mind is a very complicated thing, and so learning is complicated. But we actually know very little about what works in higher education. Most colleges couldn't really tell you how much their students are learning. They don't know which of their professors are doing a good job, which of them aren't, other than student evaluations, which actually aren't a very reliable measure of that, because they don't gather much information. They simply kind of leave it to the professor to decide who learned it, who didn't, and then go upon their way. The great thing about digital learning environments is that a lot more of the information is actually recorded and saved, and so we can analyze it. We can conduct experiments. We can iterate and get better over time, and I think that's one of the reasons that I'm optimistic about the potential for this kind of technology-driven education. We'll have a research base that we can use to figure out what works in a way that we really never have had before.
Well, you're describing an ideal, and what I worry about is what's happening in organizations across the country and around the world, where as we are in this moment of internet technology change, we see people doing 50 jobs at once because they must apply their skills to the digital world plus the in-the-office world. So people are just so burned out and exhausted from this and, not backing or paying for increase in staff that's necessary when any revolution happens like this. I hope the same thing doesn't happen in this world you're describing, because it could really ruin it.
I agree with you, and I think we are buffeted by this fast-changing world and how technology is changing different kinds of institutions. The labor market, I think there's no question, has become more and more difficult. The bar is higher. That's really the main reason that so many people are trying to get a higher education, and it's the main reason that colleges have been able to charge so much money. Everybody knows that you need some kind of degree after high school to have a decent chance at the economy, and right now, the only institutions that can provide that credential are existing colleges. And so, we borrow, we pay because we feel like we have no other choice. I don't pretend to be able to solve all the problems you just talked about. I do think, however, that to the extent that having a very, very sharp set of skills and also, learning how to learn, getting some of those things that you really only get with exposure to the sciences and the humanities, a liberal arts education, which I think, those are the things that will sustain people through the kind of world you're talking about. And I think we have the potential to do a much better job of giving more people access to that kind of learning.
And think how this can be specialized. I think about the people who need an alternative kind of learning, because in nature, nothing is the same from person to person. So brains work differently. We have people, I think about these courses being specialized for those who have dyslexia and on it goes. Think of the specialization here for people who are blind or who are deaf and on it goes. It really could be quite amazing.
What's interesting about some of the college professors, actually the researchers that I talked to, that we're just scratching the surface now, Bonn is using artificial intelligence to customize education.
Yeah.
There's some really interesting work being done at Carnegie Mellon and at Stanford where they're creating online classes that actually adapt to you, the learner, as you learn.
Kevin, thank
you. Can kind of figure out where your strengths and weaknesses are
and
in a different kind of class.
Kevin, thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're out of time. Thanks for
the work
you have done. You're welcome. The End of College, Kevin Carey, Carey, on our website. The Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org. As always, this show is about the richness of life in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton.